Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
The other flaw that I see is that so many of those other jobs, they're hired off of workshops, and there's no actual experience there. There's no manipulation of sound. Do you know how to manipulate the sound of the orchestra or create a certain sound of the orchestras you work on? So I think that's all really important to treating music fairly. Like, what, you know, if you're doing Beethoven, you're doing Beethoven or Dvorak. And it's also, I think, honest for the orchestras to be able to have that skill.
All right. Well, welcome to Podium Time.
Welcome.
This is Luke. I don't get to do the introduction very much, do I? But I'll let Jeremy take over from here.
Welcome to Podium Time. I'm not going to take away from what Luke just did. I'm Jeremy, and Luke and I are here with Michael Isidore. Michael, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give our listeners who don't know you just a quick overview of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I live in the Houston area, a little suburb called Sugar Land. And I kind of have three jobs, you could say. I teach full-time high school orchestra at Dulles High School in Sugar Land. And then I also am the Philharmonia conductor with the Houston Youth Symphony. That is the second orchestra in that program, which we have five. And then my third thing is a sort of part-time in the sense with the Houston Civic Symphony. I'm the associate conductor. I do one concert a year, generally the Young Artist Competition and Concert. And then I will fill in other places where needed throughout the year.
And you do a lot of playing as well.
Yeah, I'm a full-time member with the Victoria Symphony. I'm second clarinet and substitute principal. And I used to be also part of Symphony of Southeast Texas, but we had too many school conflicts. But I still play with them on a regular basis, doing Daphnis and Chloe and Rachmaninoff this year on two of their concerts.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I'm fortunate to get to still play with them a little bit. So,
what Rachmaninoff are you doing?
Second Symphony. I'll be playing bass clarinet on that.
Mm. Oh, bless. I'm jealous.
So, and E-flat clarinet on the Daphnis, so I've got a lot of work to do in the next couple months.
How do you balance that? You've got the full-time, you're conducting all these other groups, plus you're playing. What does your schedule look like?
Well, I tell the kids this all the time, that they have to prioritize with their schoolwork and being able to practice. And it's the same thing for me. There are times where I don't play my instrument as much as I would like because I'm doing conducting things. And then as I approach a concert cycle, that hat switches, and I have to make sure I spend more time on my instrument. I have a couple hobbies, you know, to do, and pretty much I can choose to practice or go to one of those hobbies. So I end up practicing more as we approach, and something has to drop off. But I do think it's really important to continue to play as a conductor. I think that's brought me a lot of insight that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And I would love to elaborate on that.
I was about to ask if you would.
I was gonna say, yeah, that's one of the main reasons why we're talking to you.
Yeah, I was originally asked why I still play, and I think it's just great to do both. I've learned so many different works by being in a professional orchestra and getting to be exposed to pieces that I wouldn't. And even more importantly is being on the creative side of a player. That's generally why most of us went into music in the first place. And I come back, my rehearsal pace gets faster. You know, I'm always listening and playing with conductor ears as well. I just think it's a great addition to keep working on skills.
Mm-hmm. When I started conducting, I also found that it worked the other way, that my playing as an orchestral musician got much better once I started thinking about and listening, like you said, with the conductor ears.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I find myself much more aware than I probably was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I know for myself, you know, I played in a community orchestra, and just seeing, it's one of those things like watching somebody else conduct from the perspective of a musician. For me, it was a lot of, you know, what works in rehearsals, what doesn't work in rehearsals, what maybe would you have done differently, that, you know, given a situation down the road, you can look back and be like, oh, I remember sitting there as a horn player for, you know, 45 minutes while the string players were being rehearsed, and I was really annoyed by that, you know. And so it's one of those things, like, you know, you get to kind of see and experience everything from the musician's perspective. At least for me, still does give me a better understanding of what I hope my musicians are experiencing during my rehearsals.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. And I was just, that made me think of in class, you know, I forget how nervous some of these students get when they're having to play in front of their peers, the high school level, when you just go down the line for something as simple as a whole note. And that's always like a reminder when I see a kid get really nervous. Man, I forgot that half of you guys are terrified right now. we still got to make them play in front of each other. That's what helps them get over that. But then it just changes your perspective about, you know, what they are maybe capable of doing. Uh-huh. Can generally be greater than what they're doing if they're really nervous. So.
Yeah, everything starts to shut down. Well, and I think, you know, if you're at a workshop or something, it's kind of like that. It's like, oh, half of these conductors are terrified right now. So, yeah. I wasn't really going anywhere with that. It's just...
Yeah, no, you just brought back my terrified memories.
You can just elaborate on how terrified Luke gets when he goes to conducting workshops with Jeremy, and Jeremy's so confident, and then Luke gets up there and it's a ragdoll.
Yes, I was gonna say.
Or a pretzel at the Farberman.
And so, Michael, you're preparing a lot of music, and at different levels of music. I'm sure you have different levels through you know, through your kids at school and in the youth symphony. Could you just talk about how you study scores for a little bit?
Sure. I generally read through scores a lot, where I kind of read them like a book and want to kind of get a general overview first. And then I get more serious and usually start with just marking some of the tempo structures, big structure, and then I go back in for phrase structure. That's sort of my biggest go-to, is that phrase structure. Then from there, I start looking at, you know, the instruments and melody and harmony, all of that. I am probably ashamed to admit that my harmonic analysis is not as strong as some of my teachers would like, and I tend to gravitate towards, you know, color and flow, I guess you could say, more so than knowing exactly what every note is. I'm doing right now the Hanson Marymount Suite with the youth orchestra, and that score has brought a lot of challenges because there's a lot of odd doublings where you have the English horn playing with the viola in this spot, but then it turns to bass clarinet and viola, you know, four bars later. And so I find myself really marking in that score groups of notes together, or groups of instruments together, and who's playing the primary theme and who's playing a secondary material, and even sometimes a third material because it gets so dense at times. I think if it's more simple, then I don't get into that level of detail. I kind of hope that I know it well enough that I don't bracket melody, so to speak. With the school group, you know, when we're doing younger level pieces, I think it's really important that the conductor has a clear image of what they want that piece to sound, and the structure, everything's really pretty for string orchestra music's pretty, I hate to say, pretty simple. You know, a lot of ABA, they're very even phrases, etc. So you just kind of have to know the tempos that you want to hit and the style that you want, so you can teach and be consistent in rehearsal. But, you know, our top group's doing a movement of the Bartok Divertimento. And that one I went through just like I was working with the community orchestra. I mean, I've marked every phrase in that thing because it's not symmetrical at all, you know.
Yeah, that's not an easy piece.
Yeah, they're having fun with it, I hope.
So outside of phrase markings and stuff, what other things do you really think about as far as, like, if you were studying the same score for, you know, adults as you were for a group of high school students, what are some things that you would really focus on with the younger students that you might not focus on as much with the older, more mature musicians and vice versa?
I would say I don't really study it any differently, but I think the way that I would teach it would be different. So the score study is about the same. But when I work with the younger students, you end up having to maybe layer a little bit more than you would with the community orchestra. So with the youth orchestra or the community orchestra, I'm seeing them only once a week. So I have to put it together differently than if I'm with them every day. Also, case in point, if you're dealing with techniques, like I'm having to teach, you know, a certain skill, even legato bow, then I might devise some intro technique ideas. Some people, I hate using the word warm up, but something at the beginning of the rehearsal that then reinforces what we'll do in the piece, which is why I don't like to call it warm up. But so I'll do that, and I'll do that maybe every day or every other day, and move through. But whereas the older people, you know, I have to show them the technique and sort of throw it out there of, okay, you need to work on that and come back. As far as musically, I would say musically, I kind of stay the same. I mean, I don't change musically what I'm going to try to do between the two. If the group is younger, let's say we have 6 orchestras at the high school. Each one has about 30 kids in it. Well, some a little bit more. So if I'm with, let's say, the third group or the fourth group, my conducting is going to be different. It's going to be maybe more generic or more basic, especially early on. And with the top group, as we're approaching concerts, it's going to be, you know, hopefully more artistic. And then with the youth orchestra, I'd say the same. At the early parts of the rehearsals, you know, it's, you know, more clear, more like getting through. And as they really learn the shape and the phrases and everything, then I will hopefully transition to something a little bit more artistic.
As a clarinet player, you know, you mentioned how you were having to teach them technique, you know, some of the younger kids technique and stuff. How do you handle the more advanced techniques and stuff as far as, like, as a wind player? You know, I myself being a wind player, I'm always a little concerned that not being a string player will be a hindrance to me on the podium. As far as, like, really conveying ideas and such, how do you as a clarinet player go about that and navigating that whole aspect of conducting?
Well, when I was in grad school, I actually took violin lessons with the intent of being a conductor. So when I worked with a violin professor at UMKC, we talked about, you know, mostly bow and manipulation of sound. And then violin was actually my first instrument when I was 9. So I have a little bit of comfort with it. I'm not going to go play a concerto or anything, but I do okay on, you know, some of the school music. But I'm kind of go off on a little tangent here. One of my favorite conductors growing up or motivation was Carl St. Clair. And I worked with St. Clair at a summer festival as an orchestral musician. And also I watch him whenever he does the Texas All-State groups. And he was always talking about string technique and sound quality. You know, play in this part of the bow, do this. So with the older students and the upper level techniques, I will look to those that seem to be on top for a little bit of validation. Like, okay, am I off the wall here with X technique? I'm asking you to do this. And if there's no objections, it's good. I find myself doing that a lot with the community orchestra because I have to balance the concept of they're not here every day as a school group, but they also really do need technique and guidance of where to play in the bow and how to play in the bow. So I will oftentimes make a comment and then defer to the principal players and to make sure that they're in agreement with that or have something to add to it. But I just kind of go, I mean, I just do it. I mean, I think as a non-string player, well, the best compliment I got was when a cellist in our community group thought I was a cellist. That was the best compliment I got. She didn't really know who I was, and it was the first rehearsal, and I went up there, and I just started, and at the break or after rehearsal, she thought I was a cellist. And it was just talking about the techniques, but it's all driven by what you want musically.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned studying violin with the intent to become a conductor. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about just how you got into conducting. What led you down this path?
Well, I grew up in a musical household. My dad was a band director and my mom was an orchestra teacher. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into music, and I did go into music. And as I said, I played violin early on, but then we moved and I played clarinet, kind of like my dad. I wanted to sort of follow him. He's a clarinetist and an oboist. And then when I graduated with undergrad, I went to grad school with a clarinet performance degree. And at that point, I kind of knew I wanted to conduct, but I didn't know how to go about it. In undergrad, I knew I wanted to conduct. I'm going to backtrack again. I actually got a conducting degree in grad school as well. So I have two grad degrees. And so when I was looking for grad work, I was looking for conducting. My senior year at Baylor, Mr. Hyde took me under his wing as an undergrad, and I was one of his private conducting students and had lessons with him and his grad student. So I didn't realize at the time how special that was, but he gave me lessons alongside his graduate student together. Then the three of us split the concert orchestra, which at that time was a one-night-a-week campus orchestra. Now it's a second orchestra at Baylor that they rehearse, you know, three times a week like any other class. But at the time, it was just a one night. So Mr. Hyde had put me on the podium as an undergrad in orchestra. So then I went to UMKC and got my two degrees and, you know, came graduating and go, what do I do now? And I decided, well, if I'm going to teach, I'm going to come back to Texas and I'm going to teach orchestra because I want to be better in all things string skill with the intent of hopefully being, you know, a conductor. And, well, I've been here ever since and I just keep adding things to my plate. So I'm at the same school that I was when I took that job. And, you know, there's a little bit of a flaw in that concept where I took the job so I could become better at strings, better at manipulating sound. And unfortunately, with that comes sort of a negative mark that I'm now an education conductor instead of a conductor. I don't know if you guys have experienced or have anybody ever talk about that.
Yeah, and actually, I know we have some listeners that have struggled with that. A couple that I know in person who have asked us actually to ask you about that. And we talked about it that the first time that we chatted, which we don't have the recording of that anymore, which is why we're here today. But could you talk about that a little bit? Kind of that stigma.
Yeah, there's two huge pet peeves I have with the sort of the conducting industry. And the first is that if for some reason you're in an education environment, you are not as good or you're not as musical if you're not in that environment. And I mean, I know one school in the area that's done Schoenberg and all sorts of stuff. And these are musicians that I highly respect and conductors that I highly respect. I remember some of my teachers talking about, you know, if you end up going into education, you're going to be, you know, you get labeled, and when they start looking at professional type jobs, you know, you end up with the, oh, you're the high school guy or you're the junior high person. The other flaw that I see is that so many of those other jobs, they're hired off of workshops. You know, how many workshops have people been to? And there's no actual experience there. There's no manipulation of sound. Do you know how to manipulate the sound of the orchestra or create a certain sound of the orchestras you work on? And the professionals don't just do that. That's why all the professional conductors, each orchestra sounds different with a different conductor in front of them. So I think that's all really important to treating music fairly, like what, you know, if you're doing Beethoven, you're doing Beethoven or Dvorak. And it's also, I think, honest for the orchestras to be able to have that skill. So that's a frustration of mine. I was didn't make a final round for a community orchestra job because I was told I didn't have international experience on my resume. And the community orchestra had no violas and would use a couple students from other high schools as their viola section. And and I was entirely overlooked. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, they need somebody that's going to be able to work on those skills as well. So with that said, I would encourage people to do what they need to do to be authentic musicians. And for me, that was working where I'm working. I love working with these students. They function at a high level. And I think, honestly, some of that has been created over time. And then add to it. Continue to play. Continue to conduct other groups and church groups and get involved with the community and see where it'll take you.
I like that you pointed out that those jobs seem to be looking for workshop experience, but workshops are predominantly not about rehearsing and actually preparing a full concert. Very often they're mostly just about physical communication, but there's much more to the craft than that. So I appreciate you pointing out that shaping and leading and you know, at the actual beyond just the literal conducting side of conducting.
Yeah, that's a big thing for me. That's just been one of the things that I tend to go to, and I've played in a lot of groups where the conductor expects the musicians to create the sound, but doesn't necessarily have a visual of the sound that they're trying to get. And so depending on who they're playing, they get different sounds. And that, going back to Carl St. Clair, that's just what grabbed me as a young student, was if Carl St. Clair can be this picky, and I hope he doesn't mind me name dropping him on the air. But, you know, I think one of the questions you asked me was about somebody that led me into the conducting world. And that was the person that I eventually thought of for motivation. And so, but yeah, that was my takeaway from him, as a trumpet player who was really big into, you know, what sound he wanted, whether he was working with the professional summer festival or the Allstate groups. He still had the same goals and the same motivation behind his music.
I was hoping you could actually talk about programming. Again, you've got a wide range of players that you're programming for. Could you talk about kind of your process and all the things that you're thinking about when you're selecting music?
Well, there's some other limitations other than me having free reign over programming. So for instance, with the community orchestra, I typically do the young artist concert. which means we have competition, and we pick two winners that do a movement, and that's sort of the middle of the program. And usually I will pick a large work like a symphony for the second half, and if there's time, then a short work to open. If we end up with a longer symphony, then we'll just start right with the concertos. This year I'm doing a concert in a church. I have to switch concerts with the main conductor, and pieces that we were looking at are not going to play well in that environment because it's a very live environment.
Yeah.
So there's a music selection committee, and they kind of all discussed that, and I gave some input on pieces that the orchestra wanted to play and pieces that I wanted to conduct, and then the hall, and we kind of came up with a consensus for a program. With the youth orchestra, I'm sort of stuck in the middle because I do the second group. So I have to sort of look at what the percussion needs are of the symphony group first, because we share some percussionists, and what the assignments are. And then from there, I also need to program something that uses everybody. Like, my time slot for Houston Youth Symphony is about 20 to 23 minutes. And so I want everybody to be involved. So I don't want to spend 15 minutes on something with no trombones, and even though it's great music. So I have to make sure that it's got a full representation. So there's that challenge. And then I would say with all the groups, I try to make a varied program. I've been told that people like my programs, but it's a whole lot of shot in the dark and what goes with what. So our first concert here at the high school, we're doing three movements of Holberg Suite. Then I have a harpist, so I need to get her involved. So we're doing Sospiri. And then the last movement of the Bartok Divertimento. So when you look at that program, it's really varied. Like, there's three different playing styles for each of those pieces. And I try to do that even with the younger levels, that the programs balance each other in terms of it's not all the same sound. And, you know, they even have to play them differently. Yeah, and another thing that I feel passionately about is that we do a lot of contemporary music. So a couple of years ago, we were at Midwest, and other than a Purcell arrangement, the oldest piece was 2006. And then the next chunk was all up in there, and it was, you know, Theophanidis was on there, and then a local composer here in the Houston area, Pierre Jalbert, has a couple wonderful string orchestra works. And then we had two world premieres on that same program. One educational, Kurt Mosier wrote us a piece, which is a great piece, Reverie. And then a friend of mine, Jason Nitsch, said, hey, can I write you a piece? And he does a lot with electronics. So we actually did electronics with the string orchestra. With the youth orchestra, last year we did John Mackey's Red Line Tango, the original orchestral instrumentation. And in past year, we usually do one modern piece a year, or contemporary piece, rather. I can't think of some of the other names that we just recently had done. I know we did Red Cape Tango. It's not that I'm into red tangos, it's just that one just popped into my head, that we did about 5 years ago. Super Maximum, Kenji Bunch. That's a great piece.
Is that the piece that starts with the steel with the hammers at the beginning and everyone's stomping on the stage?
Yes.
That's a very cool piece. Yeah, I know that one.
Which is actually originally a string orchestra piece.
I didn't know that.
It's originally a string orchestra piece. You can purchase it from the same place that you rent it. I believe that's Bill Holub Music. And I wanted to do it this year, but I only have one bass in my varsity orchestra, and you need to split them antiphonally. So it's definitely better with a larger string orchestra, because you split them in half, and like, you put cellos on the left and the right half of the orchestra. But that's one on my list.
Uh-huh. Do in the future. Yeah, I wandered into a rehearsal last summer, and they were the NRO over here in Colorado was doing Super Maximum, and I was just like, I've never heard of this, but this is a cool piece.
And Kenji's a violist too, so the viola gets like the melody the whole time. It's great.
Yeah.
So is Luke at MSU?
Yeah, Luke's in Missouri. I don't know where
Oh,
he's.
Missouri. I was thinking Michigan State.
Oh no, yeah, Missouri State.
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
There's.
the harmonic analysis of the orchestral guy at Michigan State is intense. I feel pretty small after going to that workshop. I
Oh,
highly recommend.
how does he
I highly
teach?
recommend it. Oh, it's on another level. I feel
Yeah.
like a I feel like a high school theory student after going to that workshop. So
Is that
Kevin, no.
Noe? Kevin, no. Okay,
Kevin,
yeah, he's on
Kevin.
our he's we've been told by a couple people to reach out to him for an interview.
Yeah, he's like phenomenal, mind-blowing with score analysis.
Yeah.
And he has a cool thing that they use called the bubbler, and you actually put the phrases in on the computer and it bubbles them and you can actually see them and attach recordings to them. And
Huh.
so you can go, I want to hear the exposition and play a recording of the exposition while watching the phrase markings that you did, then immediately jump to the recapitulation and see how it differs.
Oh, yeah.
I have not experimented with that, but I need to. It was, again, it was mind-blowing. Anyways.
Yeah. It's, I mean that I guess that comparison is something you can kind of do with a piece of paper, but it's much more effective, I think, to make it visual and actually play the recordings.
It was it's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
When we go back to score study, I do all the phrases and kind of look at them, but it's really hard to compare, the recap and the exposition like back to back like that. I mean, it takes a lot of
Yeah.
charting and counting and going, oh wait, this phrase is totally different, or this is added here, and of course, knowing that is, you need to know that, so.
Oh yeah. The problem I keep running into is that I keep getting like stuck in the page turns. Like I've been having to practice that the music goes across the page turn sometimes.
Right.
Because there was a spot in the piece where I was doing something, and there was an end of a phrase on one page and the beginning of a whole new section on the next page. And for some reason, I was putting a stop, and someone asked me why there's no stop. And I said, because there's a page turn. I don't know. That's a great question. I have no idea.
Kind of like when you're a player and you make a mental block with the end of the bar line. Or especially if the bar lines are not symmetrical, like it's manuscript and it's in the wrong spot visually.
Yes.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
the end of that page turn looks longer than it really is or something. Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
I mean, I'm one of those people that uses the lines to mark the phrases all the way through the score.
Yeah, I
And
do too.
I know some people think that that creates sort of a mental block as well, but that's the way I've been taught, and I typically use that in the Marymount Suite, the last movement. It's you hold your breath. It's an 8-bar phrase. There's two spots where it maybe extends four or two measures, and that one I don't mark everyone because it's literally 8-bar phrase. Draw the line.
Okay. Yeah.
So then in the spots that it differs, then I mark it. So typically I do like clean music. I don't like a
Okay.
lot of lines and colors and things in between. I like it generally pretty clean and much more organized than my desk.
Yeah. You mentioned some your habits outside of music earlier. I'm curious what those are.
It's a little varied. I'm gonna warn your audience up front. I've been a martial artist for many years, not a good one, but I have done kung fu, and then in the last couple years, I've been doing jiu-jitsu. That's kind of sort of for health, and I also am an avid badminton player. And in Houston, we have a 12-court badminton facility, like. within 3 miles of my house. And I'm really not a huge sports person, but I sound like I am. Before all of that, I also used to coach ice hockey. So it was very bizarre, like very different. Like, and when I was coaching and playing ice hockey, the assistant conductor of the Houston Grand Opera was on our team.
Oh, cool.
When I was playing. So it's like there's definitely musicians that play ice hockey. I only play once a week now, so I kind of split between playing Saturday night hockey and jiu-jitsu during the week, and then I'll throw in badminton once or twice. And then on the complete opposite of the spectrum, I actually knit.
Oh.
Like scarves. And, yeah, it's you'll see me carrying around a little shoulder, you know, a little shoulder bag, and inside is a, you know, a scarf that I'm working on. So it's definitely a little different. Whereas I knit, I do find the knitting is very therapeutic in the sense that we're all type A perfectionists generally as musicians, and you will make a mistake knitting, and you have two choices or all three choices to learn to live with it. That's the therapeutic one. And then, you know, undo it to fix the mistake, which sometimes is not worth all the effort. And then the third option is to completely scrap it. So that's actually what I find therapeutic about it. We're also board game players and, you know, video game people too, which I'm sure many folks are.
Yeah.
I usually carry around in my bag, not only, you know, the yarn, but there's usually a Nintendo or a Vita in there as well, and maybe a book.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely a lot of outside varied activities. But
yeah, have the sports or the martial arts influenced your conducting gestures at all?
Well, there's a reason I started Wing Chun, which was to sort of work on the bad habit that I had at the time of maybe leaning forward and not having a straight, relaxed posture while conducting. And so I was like, you know, if I do Wing Chun, I'm working on this, you know, I love, you know, the Chinese martial arts. And then at the same time, I can work on sort of my posture, which for some reason is not as relaxed and straight as I would like. And then there's a lot of circles in Wing Chun and relaxed arms. And I just remember them, you know, going, oh, you're really natural at this. I thought, well, my hands do something different for 5 hours a day. You know? Yeah. They're used to not moving at the same time. So absolutely. It was kind of also supported, you know, conducting and, you know, developing left right hand independence and being relaxed and keeping your shoulders relaxed. Probably not an answer most people would have thought, but that's actually why I started to begin with.
No, I haven't heard of it. Was it Wing Chun? But it sounds like Tai Chi. Is it similar?
They're both from the same, you know, they're both circular in a way. Wing Chun will have more straight lines, but it doesn't have the hard impact that you would see in, like, karate. Like, you know, I don't know if you've seen, like, hard karate blocks where it's sort of force on force. There's a lot more circles like Tai Chi, but it's not as soft and not as flowing like you see Tai Chi for fitness, you know, where people are doing the really slow motions.
Yeah. Yeah, Tai Chi and yoga are the two that I've been told a lot for conducting.
But yeah, one of the earliest things we did is, you know, cat washing face was the English titles that we used. And it was basically circles kind of on going around, you know, head height with, you know, relaxed wrists. And I'm doing it right now as I talk. But like you can see. yeah, and all that's, you know, that's moving from the elbow. It really supports relaxed conducting gestures. The placement often of your hand is about a fist away from your body, which is kind of the same as conducting. It's very, very interesting.
So let's see. I mean, we can start to head towards the close of this. Our billboard question is one of our favorites. Michael, if you could send a message out to maybe either, you know, a conductor or all the conductors every day, or maybe musicians every day, what message would you want to send out to people?
I would like to encourage everybody to keep playing your instrument. One of the TMEA orchestra VPs, person in charge, wrote in their article, you know, I recently started playing in a church orchestra and I forgot how much I love to play. I went into music to play. And if you're a teacher and you're teaching school, you know, don't forget about that side of your past, so to speak. And it becomes challenging, especially if you have a family and things, but finding, you know, even a group to read chamber music with every once in a while, it definitely for me just ignites the musicality and what you do on the podium. And with that being said, I would also like to encourage to do as much as you can. So if you're a student and you're studying conducting and you can conduct a new music ensemble, then conduct a new music ensemble. If there's an opportunity to do a musical, do the musical. If you know, somebody wants you to come in and work with choir, work with choir. Don't just stay in your area. I mean, they're all such different sounds, and you can learn from anybody. So it's my second thing that I've tried to do is you know, go to whatever you can. One of my favorite recital moments was listening to a masterclass moments was listening to Leon Bisey at Rice talk about using vibrato to connect, you know, skips on the flute, and then I immediately applied that to my clarinet playing. And when I work with string players, even if they're not using vibrato, because we don't use vibrato typically on clarinet, but the idea of that she was presenting at the time was matching, basically matching resonance of the lower octave before you jump up to the wherever partial the newer note is. And when I was in school, I remember going to the Joel Alessi trombone master class. Yeah, some of my friends wouldn't go because it wasn't, you know, clarinet. I said, go to whatever you can, just soak it all in, and don't say no until you are out of time or can't follow through properly.
Yeah. I like that I'm glad that you mentioned going to a master class for a different instrument. I was doing that for a while until my school got too busy, but I went into a clarinet master class one day just because I was walking by and there is nothing to do, and they were working on orchestral excerpts, and I was like, all right, great. This accidentally turned out to be like not just informative but very pertinent to something that I'll probably be coaching someday, or not coaching but rehearsing,
right?
You know. Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for this interview, and thank you for your patience with our technology. I'm glad we were able to get this working.
Yeah, well, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it. And as I told my friends, this is a big step out of my comfort zone doing an interview or speaking in front of people. So, but I'm really glad to get a chance to do this. Thank you for asking me.
Of course, yeah, and I think Angela and Neil for giving us your name and information and everything.
Yeah, I have thanked them several times as well.
Alrighty.
Talked to Neil today, in fact. So.
Oh, good. Say hi to either of them for me next time you see them. They graduated this summer and they won't be back next summer.
Yeah, and I saw recently somebody I was at a workshop with is either in the class before or the class behind you guys, or maybe in your class. It's just a small world, this music world. So
yeah,
I look forward to being able to run into you in person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely.
It'll happen.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Podium Time Podcast. Please connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or reach out on our website at podiumtimepod.wordpress.com. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Liguori.